You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
It's the paradigm of the wagon train versus the swarthy hordes, first enunciated very well by a marvelous article by Tom Engelhardt in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It could be happening in the American Wild West. It could be in the Amazon jungle, the North African desert, the Sudan, the Transvaal, the South Pacific jungles, or Indochina. The scene is generally the same. There's a fort, or an encampment, or a wagon train. And inside that encampment are the human beings. They're white. They're human. They're warm, they're attractive, they talk, and they're nice. Outside come the swarthy hordes, the savages. They can be Indians, they can be Bushmen, they can be Arabs on camels and horses or whatever else. And they are the subhumans, and they are attacking the human beings. And the wagons form their circle. And the human beings know what to do. They level their guns and they begin to knock off, shoot, and kill these screaming savages who attack them. Why do the swarthy hordes attack the white people? You don't know. They never tell you. Is it to protect their lands? Is it to protect their herds? Is it to protect their villages and their towns and their families and their children? No, it's just because they like to do that. That's their thing. They like to attack. And so they have to be killed. And by the way, it's not even bravery that they manifest as they charge in great numbers and get cut down in horrible numbers. This is not even bravery, although similar acts by whites would be portrayed as heroic. This itself is portrayed as a manifestation of the swarthy hordes, their fanatic, crazed way of wanting to bloodlust. Now the trouble with this paradigm is that it turns the history of the last 400 years on its head. That it reverses the roles of usurper and usurped. It reverses the roles of victim and victimizer. It reverses the roles of those who were massacred and those who were doing the massacring. It was the European and North American civilizers, so-called, who went in there and destroyed the villages and destroyed their industries and destroyed their townships. Read Engels on North Africa, what happened to the Arabs and Berbers, and when he goes in and describes the beautiful towns with the fine, hard stone and plaster buildings and their woolen industries and their mining industries and their arts and crafts and all that. And then read the description of the French troops coming in and systematically destroying it and killing every man, woman, and child. Read about how the Germans went into South Africa and killed the Herero tribe. 80,000 people, they killed 60,000 of them, and the other 20,000 they used as slave labor in their minds. Read Mark Twain's angry, raging comments about King Leopold of Belgium, calling him a mad dog and what he did to the innocent, unoffending people of the Congo, taking them and enslaving them, 1 million of them a year dying in the mines in the Congo. That's what the history's about. That's what John Wayne is about. And what these films do is they reverse that history, stand it on its head. They do what Joseph Goebbels said. They give you a big lie, and they embellish it, and they make you root for the guys in the wagon train.
Hello, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends. This is Back in the USSR. I am Siegfried, and thanks for tuning in. Now, I want to begin by explaining why I did not do a new show last week. I mean, you might have noticed that I played an older show from last month where I expressed my solidarity with the Palestinian people, and in particular the people of the besieged Gaza Strip, who at the time were facing lethal violence from the Israeli army every Friday, as they peacefully demonstrated for their rights as a people in the face of a brutal colonial regime. Now, those protests began on March 30th and continued until Nakba, Catastrophe Day, which happened last Tuesday, May 15th, when the Palestinians marked the hostile takeover of their lands in 1948 by the new Israeli state. Last Monday, May 14th, the United States, acting in defiance of world opinion as well as international law, opened an embassy in Jerusalem and recognized that city as the undivided capital of Israel in an open assault on Palestinian aspirations for a viable independent state with East Jerusalem as its capital. That was effectively torn up on that day. And so on that day, there were massive demonstrations from the Palestinian people and the people of Gaza. They protested once again and once again. Unarmed demonstrators were met by the sniper rifles of the Israeli army. 62 Palestinians died that day, thus eclipsing the entire death toll since the protest began on March 30th, eclipsing that death toll in less than 24 hours. And this was not indiscriminate shooting on the part of the Israeli military. These are soldiers armed with precision weapons, aiming and deliberately shooting individual unarmed Palestinians through their sniper scopes. This was cold-blooded murder in the fullest sense. And as Michael Parenti said in that opening clip there, this was a clear case of the wagon train versus the swarthy hordes, with the so-called civilized Israeli soldiers mowing down the, quote, savage Palestinians whom they dehumanize, brutalize, and murder with impunity. And of course, the Western media also does this. When it engages in false balancing and tries to pass pass off this one-sided colonial massacre in terms of, quote, clashes or some similar trite phrase that implies that both sides are somehow to blame or that the unarmed Palestinian demonstrators were somehow asking for it when they were shot in cold blood. So you have the New York Times saying on May 14th that, quote, a violent mass attempt by Palestinians to cross the border fence separating Israel from Gaza turned violent as Israeli soldiers responded with rifle fire. You know, that was their headline. And as my friend Greg Shupak has pointed out, this kind of reporting paints, quote, Israel's rampage as a reaction to a Palestinian provocation, which it was not. That same day, the New York Times editorial board went even further. You know, quote, led too long by men who were corrupt or violent or both, the Palestinians have failed and failed again to make their own best efforts towards peace. Even now, Gazans are undermining their own cause by resorting to violence rather than keeping their protests strictly peaceful. The mainstream capitalist media blamed the Palestinians for the bloodshed. You know, they blame them basically for their own deaths at the hands of Israeli snipers. You know, you have a Yahoo article from May 14th reading, quote, violent protests in Gaza ahead of U.S. embassy inauguration in Jerusalem. Bloomberg also on May 14th, Hamas targets fence as Gaza bloodshed clouds embassy move. And a BBC report from May 15th that states, quote, Gaza braced for further violent protests. And all these headlines blame, basically have the common effect of blaming the Palestinians for the lethal force used against them, effectively accusing them of violence and not their killers, you know, letting their killers virtually completely off the hook. And Business Insider on May 14th, they said, quote, Palestinian protesters who ramped up their activities along the Gaza Strip and as a result were targeted by the Israeli army with increasing intensity. You know, once again attacking the protesters for throwing rocks and burning tires, while the IDF had sniper rifles and tanks that it certainly was not afraid to use against unarmed people. Unarmed people, whom the Washington Post on May 15th referred to as being only, quote, nominal civilians. To once again quote Greg Shupak, the media portrays the Palestinians as inherently threatening, intrinsically killable, always suspect, never innocent, permanently guilty of existing. It's truly disgusting. It's absolutely disgusting. The way the media demonizes these people who were, you know, murdered. So I couldn't do my show last week. You know, in the aftermath of such an atrocity, it was too much for me to handle. You might have noticed that every week since the Great March of Return began at the end of March, I've been naming the dead. Naming the individual shot down in cold blood by the Israeli state. If I had done the show last week, I would have had to name 62 people, 62 individuals with faces, names, lives, and stories to tell, and I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. Instead, I went to the Guelph Poetry Slam at the E-Bar in downtown Guelph. I used to be a regular there, but it had been like 2 years since I last attended an event like that. And I got up in front of everyone and I performed the following poem by a Irish Republican hunger striker who gave his life for his people in a British jail in 1981. And I did it for Palestine, just as Bobby Sands himself would have wanted me to do if he was still with us now. It's called the Rhythm of Time.
There's an inner thing in every man. Do you know this thing, my friend? It has withstood the blows of a million years and will do so to the end. It was born when time did not exist, and it grew up out of life. It cut down evil, strangling veins like a slicing, searing knife. It lit fires when fires were not, and burnt the mind of men, tempering leaden hearts to steel from the time that time began. It wept by the waters of Babylon, and when all men were a loss, it screeched in writhing agony, and it hung bleeding from the cross. It died in Rome by land and sword in defiant cruel array, when the deathly word was Spartacus along the Appian Way. It marched with Wat the tailors poor, and frightened lord and king, and it was emblazoned in their deathly stir as ere a living thing. It smiled in holy innocence before conquistadors of old, so meek and tame and unaware of the deathly power of gold. It burst forth through pitiful Paris streets and stormed the old Bastille, and marched upon the serpent's head and crushed it neath its heel. It died in blood on buffalo plains and starved by moons of rain. Its heart was buried in wounded knee, but it will come to rise again. It screamed along by Kerry lakes as it knelt upon the ground, and it died in great defiance as they coldly shut it down. It is found in every light of hope. It knows no bounds nor space. It has risen in red and black and white. It is there in every race. It lies in the hearts of heroes dead. It screams in tyrants' eyes. It has reached the peaks of mountain high. It comes searing across the skies. It lights the dark of this prison cell. It thunders forth its might. It is the undauntable thought, my friend, that thought that says I'm right.
This next song I'm going to do is dedicated to the 14 innocent civilians whose lives were cruelly taken away from them from the Royal Paratroop Regiment on Bloody Sunday. A song called Sunday, Bloody Sunday.
Patriots of Britain, all the even call it home.
Ireland for the Irish, not for London or for Rome. Sunday, bloody Sunday, bloody Sunday, the day. Sunday, bloody Sunday, bloody Sunday, the day. Sunday, bloody Sunday, bloody Sunday's the day.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
Hi everybody, this is Lee Fields. You're listening to CFRU. You heard me, CFRU.
Teens from Spain and France will be paying their annual visit to our region this summer. They will be studying English and enjoying a month of fun and sightseeing. CanadaLink English is looking for families with an extra bedroom and some spare time to host these young people in their homes for 1 month. Programs are being run in Guelph, as well as Waterloo, Cambridge, Brantford, and Fergus Alora. While in Guelph, the teens will attend English language classes every weekday morning at the University of Guelph. In the afternoon, they participate in cultural and sports activities. The program is organized so that working families who are away during the day can qualify as hosts. Families interested in learning more can contact Margaret Burnett at 519-821-1247 or by email at margaret@canadalink.com. A per-week honorarium is paid to each host family to cover expenses. For more info, including info on the programs in other cities, visit canadalink.com. That's CanadaLINC.com.
Hello, my name is Arun. I host Navrang Guelph every Saturday 11 a.m. to 12 noon on CFRU 93.3 FM. Each week we bring Bollywood music in Hindi and Punjabi, South Asian masala and gup shop, and much more. So keep listening Navrang Guelph every Saturday.
I love my India. I love my India.
Are you feeling sad?
Feeling today? Are you okay?
What's your zone? Red,
yellow,
blue,
or green?
Paisley Roads Grade 4s are here to help.
Hey, have you ever experienced going to the store and the thing you want is not there?
That might put you in the yellow zone. That is when you are stressed or close to mad.
Here are some ways to calm down and get back to the green zone.
First, take 3 deep breaths to calm down.
Or ask an employee if they have any in stock in the back of the store.
Or
go to another store to buy what you want.
Now you know your zones. Ta-da!
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. A few songs, Irish Rebel songs, I played in solidarity with Palestine, actually. As the Irish rebel movement, Republican movement, movement for independence in Ireland has long stood in solidarity with the Palestinian cause. They realize they're both facing colonialism and they stand in solidarity on that basis. And so I played The Rhythm of Time by Bobby Sands, that iconic poem that he did, that he wrote while in jail, for his actions against the British occupation in Northern Ireland in the early 1980s. And he did that. He did that poem, and that was the poem I performed at the Guelph Poetry Slam last week. Now, I also played Iarraug, which is Irish band. They just did the song "Sunday Bloody Sunday." The real rebel song "Sunday Bloody Sunday," not the U2 nonsense, which they did, which is basically just pacifist nonsense. This is actual rebel song, like calling for the British to get out of Ireland and all that stuff. Anti-colonial song, and once again playing that in solidarity with Palestine. So Now, there have been some interesting developments that have emerged in the wake of this latest atrocity against the people of Gaza. Now, notably, the UN has launched an extremely belated investigation into Israeli war crimes. That was an immensely long time coming, but this time they really had no choice. You know, even with the atrocious quality of the Western media coverage and, you know, the United States standing wholeheartedly behind Israel and, like, trying to cover up this atrocity, the whole world was outraged by what the Israeli army did and is continuing to do in Gaza. You know, I mean, it's just like there's overwhelming, you know, when they had a vote on the Human Rights Council at the UN, it was overwhelming, you know, to launch an independent investigation of Israeli war crimes in Gaza. It was overwhelming. You know, I think it was like, you know, I can't remember how many seats are exactly on there, but it was something like, you know, almost 90 votes to 9 or something like that to vote, like, to have this investigation, you know. But like I said, the Israeli army is still committing crimes against the people of Gaza. On just yesterday, on May 25th, the Ministry of Health in Gaza reported 109 people injured by Israeli sniper fire, while another man, 24-year-old Yasser Sami Habib, died of the wounds he sustained in last week's protests. Thus, he became the 67th victim of the May 14th massacre. You know, the fifth person out of the more than 2,000 injured that day to succumb to their injuries. So really, the death toll has just kept increasing, you know, since the massacre took place last week, you know, as people were, like, horribly injured, critically injured, you know, dying. Now, as commentators have pointed out with regard to the previous Israeli assaults on Gaza, the Israeli arms industry is one of the largest in the world, and it continues to literally make a killing, you know, off of the Israeli apartheid state's repression of the Palestinians, you know, testing out new weapon systems and then marketing them as battle-tested to other countries. Now, I'm going to play a recent report from The Real News that gets into that, but first I want to emphasize the growing level of international solidarity with the Palestinian cause. Protests in support of Gaza have occurred around the world. We had some significant ones happening around here in Toronto and in Waterloo. And very notably, there is a new Gaza Freedom Flotilla of activists that has just set sail that will be attempting to run the Israeli sea blockade on Gaza in the near future. There's been a number of attempts like that in the past, and they're going to go for it again. So I want to play a report on that first, on the latest Freedom Flotilla of Western activists trying to get to Gaza, because that's underway right now. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
This is Dimitri Lascaris reporting for the Real News Network from Montreal, Canada. The Gaza Strip is home to approximately 2 million Palestinians, one half of whom are children. In 2007, the State of Israel, with the cooperation of Egypt, imposed a punishing land, air, and sea blockade on Gaza. Since Israel's imposition of that blockade and following repeated military assaults on the Strip, Gaza has been rendered essentially unlivable. Approximately 97% of its water is contaminated. Its hospitals barely function and lack basic essential supplies. Electricity is supplied to its people for only a few hours a day. And in 2014, the World Bank reported that Gaza had the highest unemployment rate in the world at nearly 44%. Rather than sit idle in the face of such immense suffering, human rights activists from around the world have repeatedly attempted to break the sea blockade peacefully. In one such attempt in 2010, Israeli forces boarded in international waters a flotilla of ships carrying activists and humanitarian aid. Those forces killed 9 activists on one of those ships, the Mavi Marmara, a Turkish vessel. According to a UN report, all activist deaths were caused by gunshots, and, quote, the circumstances of the killing of at least 6 of the passengers were in a manner consistent with an extra-legal, arbitrary, and summary execution. Starting this week, human rights activists will again attempt to break the blockade of Gaza peacefully. Several ships, including a Canadian vessel, are departing this week from Copenhagen in Denmark. They will sail south through Atlantic waters and then into the Mediterranean, stopping at various ports along the way to draw attention of the world to their voyage and, above all, to the suffering in Gaza. For The Real News, I will be joining the expedition in the second half of June. Today, we are joined by 2 of the activists who are boarding the Canadian boat to Gaza. Their names are Judith Ilani and Heather Milton Lightning. Yudit is a political consultant, documentary photographer, and community activist in Israel. She works as a parliamentary consultant to Hanin Zoabi, a member of Israel's parliament, the Knesset. Heather Milton Lightning is a community organizer from Canada. She is the founder of Native Youth Movement, and she works, once worked, for the Indigenous Environmental Network as a national youth organizer. Thank you very much, Yudit and Heather, for joining us today. So, Yudit, I'd like to start with you. You are, as I mentioned a moment ago, an Israeli. You are a consultant for a member of Israel's parliament. In the circumstances, one would imagine it's rather challenging for you in the current political environment to participate in this action. Why are you doing it, and what are the risks for you personally?
I'm really obliged. I live personally very close to the Gaza border. When Gaza is bombed, I can hear it from my home. And I'm very much aware of the situation in Gaza. I have friends in Gaza, and I know this is being, Israel carries out these acts in my name, and I feel the obligation to do whatever I can to stop the blockade, because I think it's inhuman. It's a crime against humanity.
And given the fact that you are Israeli, and given the current political environment, has there been a backlash? Are you expecting a backlash from some of your compatriots about your participation in this expedition?
Yes, it is to be expected. I also participated in a women's boat to Gaza about 2 years ago. They tried to fire me for my job. I work for a small TV station. They tried to close us down. They kicked us out of our offices, basically. They tried to stop our public funding. They tried to sack me from my job. I was personally threatened. So yes, it isn't nice coming back.
And Heather, as a member of Canada's Indigenous community, do you see parallels between the struggles of Indigenous peoples in Canada and the struggle of the Palestinian people? If so, what are they?
So I had the opportunity a couple years ago to go with a delegation with Interfaith Peace Builders, a group, an organization that sends delegations over about four times a year. And so we didn't go into Gaza, but we did go to the West Bank, and we tried. They tried really intentionally to have us visit all different facets of Palestinian life, but to also get a better sense of the political climate. And I think the things that really stood out for me on that trip was just seeing the escalated violence, but also the similarities in a lot of different ways. And I think that's a thing that we can relate to, is the settler colonial machinery. And for us, that was Britain and then later Canada. And a lot of the tactics that were used by Canada, by the British Crown, are so similar in terms of, you know, not being able to leave the reservation boundaries without a pass, being the only people in Canada that by race have an identity card, which is very similar to a Palestinian identity card. There's just an ongoing list of things that are super similar. And I think the thing that stands out to me is just the high level escalated violence that Palestinian people have to deal with on a daily basis. And I think we've been in the process of dealing with this colonial machinery for a very long time, and it's stretched over a period of time. And I think there's differences in the way violence plays out in our communities, but also that is in the ways that it's inflicted by the state. And I think the thing that I really appreciate is the resilience of the Palestinian people. And I think, you know, really understanding that in my home territory, there's Palestinian families that are exiled that live there. You know, I had the opportunity to go to Standing Rock and to support the actions that were happening there against the Dakota Access Pipeline. And there were numerous Palestinian delegations that came to Standing Rock. And so I think that's the message that we've always kind of told each other, is to show up for each other in solidarity, because we understand that our struggles are they're linked together. And I think the thing that really stood out for me is really understanding how the process happened, and really understanding that there's a link with the British Crown, both with Palestine and in Canada in particular, and with a lot of other Indigenous people that were colonized by the British. And so it's really interesting to see how colonial powers have played out both historically, but in present day. And really understanding that, you know, Britain and Canada, the United States, and all these other countries, Canada in particular, as the Great March happened and the series of protests happened, and we've seen a lot of people being killed, Canada made public statements, but it hasn't imposed a sanction. It It's not going to stop doing business with Israel. It's not going to do any of those things. And so, you know, it'll pat itself on the back for being a good humanitarian publicly on Twitter, you know, all of these different things. But when it comes to taking action and imposing those, we haven't seen that yet. And I think the thing that's linked to that is Canada has 98.8% of our land, and we agreed to share it. And I think that's the thing with colonial powers, is that they have to go through a process of admitting that they stole the land and took it illegally. And I don't think Canada, United States, or Britain, or any of these other colonial powers, including Israel, are going to do that anytime soon. But that doesn't mean that we don't take action to fight back, but also to incrementally take back our rights. And we've seen that in Canada, and we've seen that, of course, with the Palestinian struggle, and also being really global. So I think that's really important to figure out the ways that we can have solidarity, and be strategic about that, and taking action is really important.
So you mentioned you live near the border of Gaza. Could you talk to us a bit about, and Heather, your colleague specifically referred to a moment ago, the Great March of Return. Can you talk to us a bit about, you know, your feelings as an Israeli living on the other side of the border about what's happened the last few weeks, and about the context in which this particular expedition is being launched? The timing of it is quite remarkable, happening as it is after the conclusion, or at least the nominal conclusion, of the Great March of Return. Could you talk to us about this context and what you've experienced as an Israeli on the other side of the border?
Well, first of all, the right of return exists and it needs to be recognized. Israel created a refugee situation in 1948 as well as in 1967. And the Palestinian refugees living in the diaspora do have a right, by the decision of the UN and by basic humanitarian rights, to return to their home country. And they are fighting for something which they are entitled to. That said, in Gaza, a large, a coalition was created of different organizations who decided to use nonviolent means in order to demand the return. And they published their decision to use nonviolent means according to the tradition of Martin Luther King, of Gandhi, of the ANC, of the ANC in South Africa. And they published this on various internet platforms, that it would be nonviolent demonstrations by civilians. Even before the first demonstration took place, the Israeli security forces announced, also on social media platforms, that they would employ snipers and that they would shoot to kill at anyone getting close to the border. Now, the right to have a demonstration is a legal right. The place where they have the demonstration is the Gaza Strip. It is theirs. I also recognize that beyond it, it's theirs. But it is a civil act of demonstrating. And the fact that Israel employs snipers to kill means that Israel is committing war crimes. Israel is committing crimes against humanity. You don't shoot at civilians, and they use live bullets, and they said they would do so. There are thousands of people wounded. Most of them have been shot in the upper body, so they're shooting to kill. And amongst the dead, and I've even lost count because there are so many, there are children, there are women, there are journalists also amongst the wounded, and they have all been, you know, they're basically being murdered. So Israeli soldiers are committing crimes, and this is being done in my name, but not that I agree to it.
Now, lastly, I'd like to talk to you about the geographical and political environment in which you currently find yourselves, namely Europe. There have been numerous efforts by European authorities to suppress Palestinian solidarity activism. For example, France has gone so far as to sue BDS activists. And last year, during the presidential campaign, French President Emmanuel Macron stated, "Boycotting Israel has been condemned by France, and there's no reason why we should discuss the matter again." So I'd like you both to talk a bit about the differences that you've seen in terms of official European policy towards Israel and towards your expedition, and the reaction of the people on the street in Europe. And perhaps, Heather, you could start there. Tell us about, you know, how are Europeans, grassroots Europeans, responding to your expedition?
That's a great question. And I'm not sure I can give you an answer because I just got here today. So I haven't really had the opportunity to get a really good pulse on the ground about how people are feeling. I think when it comes to policy, particularly when France is saying no to BDS, we've seen the same thing in Canada. There's been numerous legislation tries to push against BDS. We've seen colleges and universities try and obliterate BDS from on campus and doing work there. I think that just shows to me that the campaign is really effective. And, you know, we've seen celebrities and different people of influence that have gotten pushed by BDS and in the right way. And I think that's really important. And I think it's all about strategy and about tactics and about being really emboldened and empowered by that. And if we have governments like France coming out against BDS, then I can only say that I think that it's effective and it's working for them to be backing up Israel. However, it's effective in a way that they're taking a stance and maybe not in the right direction. So we still have work to do, but I think it's a really effective campaign.
And Judith, have you had a chance to gauge the sort of grassroots reaction amongst Europeans towards this particular expedition?
Well, obviously, in every I joined the boat about a week ago, and in every harbor we've met with amazing people supporting, presenting us with food, with works of art, doing graffiti, all kinds of activities pro-Palestine and pro-Gaza and in favor of the boats to Gaza. So the welcoming has been amazing. We have spoken a lot about BDS. Most people are very much aware of the need to boycott and of BDS. What I think is important, however, is also to stress the D in BDS, the disinvestment, because that is much less obvious and needs to be done as well. And as to BDS, also within Israel, there is something which we call BDS from within. And this is being criminalized in Israel. So it is quite difficult to carry. I mean, we can carry it out easily enough, but we cannot publish it. So I feel very comfortable calling from abroad to support BDS. It's really important because it is very successful. Israel, it's under great pressure because of BDS, and it's important to carry it out and to continue carrying it out all over Europe, all over the world, and also from within.
Well, this has been Dimitri Lascaris speaking to Judith Illini and Heather Milton-Lightning, two passengers and activists on the Canadian boat to Gaza, which is disembarking shortly from Copenhagen. Thank you very much for joining us here on The Real News.
Thank you for having us.
And this is Dimitri Lascaris reporting from Montreal, Canada.
It's The Real News. I'm Ben Norton. I'm joined by Andrew Feinstein, who is a leading expert on the arms industry. He's the executive director of Corruption Watch UK and the author of the book The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade, which was recently made into a film. Andrew is also a former member of parliament for the ANC in South Africa. Thanks for joining us, Andrew.
Great to be with you.
Today we're going to be discussing the role of Israel in the U.S. arms industry, and specifically the protests in Gaza. For the past 6 weeks now, protesters inside Gaza have been leading nonviolent demonstrations and being gunned down en masse. There have been large massacres of unarmed protesters by Israel, and in fact, on Monday, dozens more Palestinians were killed. Thousands have been shot with live ammunition, including some experimental forms of munitions used by the Israeli military against unarmed peaceful protesters inside Gaza. How is this also related to Israel's role in the U.S. and global arms trade?
So a crucial component of the arms trade, and a growing component, perhaps the fastest growing there is the broad area of homeland security and of surveillance and repression equipment. By Israel attacking what are effectively, by all accounts, peaceful protesters, although of course Israel will reflect on them as something very different to that, Israel will then use that information, particularly with non-democratic, autocratic regimes around the world, the regimes of Saudi Arabia, of the United Arab Emirates, of various other countries of similar political systems. And they will say to them, we have this problem on a daily basis. Look how we are addressing it. So we have these protests, which are a threat to Israel's national security, which in itself is a very questionable point, but that's how they would argue it. And they would then continue the argument that look how we deal with this. Through our surveillance equipment, our equipment of ongoing repression of the occupied territories, we know exactly what the Palestinians are planning and when they are going to plan it. We know who the ringleaders are, and this is how we deal with it, with not just brute force, but also the competitive advantage that our technology gives us. And they will speak to a variety of weaponry that is actually illegal to be used in the world. But Israel is signatory to very few of those multilateral agreements, such as the treaty to ban cluster munitions. So we have seen time after time the use of cluster munitions, the use of various chemical weapons in the occupied territories by Israel, and the marketing of these weapons. So how does this affect the United States of America? First of all, because of the relationship between the US government and the Israeli government, between US defense contractors and Israeli defense contractors, many of whom have a very big state component to their composition, it is possible to be testing what are effectively illegal forms of ammunition and weaponry in Israel's activities. And second of all, it ensures that the United States can use similar marketing devices to the Israelis in selling their defense sector as a key component of the growing homeland security, surveillance, and repression industry. So that is the sort of the marketing, the economic dimension. I should also mention that there is a very important political dimension to all of this as well. Now, the reality of the arms trade is that it's by far the most corrupt trade in the world. A gentleman by the name of Joe Rober at Transparency International at the time calculated that the arms trade is responsible for around 40% of all corruption in world trade. And one of the reasons for this is the very close relationships between defense contractors and governments. Governments both in their myriad state forms, but also in the form of political parties and individual politicians. And we have seen massive amounts of money flow into political campaigning across the political divides in the United States of America and in Israel. It's most apparent in the US, where one can actually track the vast amounts of money that are given to individual candidates and to political parties, and the projects that those individual politicians get back for those defense contractors in their home states or districts. So the other thing that the symbiotic relationship with Israel does is it keeps this flow of money going constantly, so that everybody who benefits from the defense sector, what Lawrence Wilkerson refers to as the national security elite globally, that the flow of money continues to flow amongst the defense contractors, the individual executives, not just amongst political parties, but also amongst individual politicians and individual campaigns. And this really underpins both the American and the Israeli political systems. So it's another reason why the relationship between the two is so incredibly intertwined.
Yeah, and on that subject, numerous Gulf regimes, including Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates, also expressed joy and support in response to Trump's decision to withdraw from the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. As you show in your book and in your movie, these Gulf monarchies are also major customers for U.S. weapons. They have bought billions of dollars in U.S. military equipment. Can you comment on the relationship of these Gulf monarchies to the Iran deal?
Saudi Arabia in particular, to a lesser extent, the states of the Gulf Cooperation Council, and of course Israel, have been calling on the U.S. government to attack Iran for certainly most of the two decades almost that I've been working in this area. And the reason for that is really about control of the Middle East region. And here the issue is The only real threat to a Saudi-Israel-US access in the region is Iran. Now, President Obama saw the way of addressing that as coming to this nuclear peace deal with Iran, making Iran more of a trading partner by doing away with the sanctions and ensuring that there was no potential for Iran to develop nuclear weapons. But to Saudi and Israel in particular, as well as some other countries of the region, this was absolute anathema, because this meant that Iran could also become an economic, not just a political power in the region, and this affected their hegemony in the region, just as it affects American hegemony in the region. So they have a common political agenda. But there is another irony of this situation, and that is that Saudi Arabia in particular, and the states of the UAE to some extent as well, are not only the second biggest purchasers of weaponry in the world behind the United States of America, so an absolutely crucial marketplace to the companies and to their political sponsors, but as crucially, Saudi Arabia in particular, through its Wahhabi ideology, through its clandestine support for various groups that are described by the United States of America as Islamist groups or Islamic extremist groups, Saudi Arabia is actually a part of the national security problem that our political leaders are arguing we need to keep defense budgets at $700 billion plus a year in order to thwart. So we are actually supporting with weaponry and with regional political support some of those who are ultimately undermining our own national security. And this is the extraordinary irony of the role of the arms trade in the world at the moment, and the way in which it interacts with geopolitics, is that we claim that these industries are an essential part of our national security, that they are essential to our own personal defense. But at the same time, by our alliances with countries like Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, we're actually selling weaponry to countries who, it's been shown, have supported some of the violence that we are trying to get rid of in the world.
Well, we'll have to end our conversation there. I was joined by Andrew Feinstein, who is the executive director of Corruption Watch UK and the author of the book, The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade, which was recently made into a new film. Thanks for joining me, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
Reporting for The Real News, I'm Ben Norton.
Hey, listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. So that was a couple of reports from The Real News there. One from was just Dimitri Lascaris talking about the Freedom Flotilla that has just set sail from Copenhagen to Gaza to break the blockade, to break the Israeli blockade or attempt to. And then, of course, we had Ben Norton talking about the Israeli arms trade and how it benefits from the massacres going on in Gaza and uses it to actually market its weapons around the world, you know, to countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar and places like that. Now, and of course, you can find all these talks and whatnot on my blog, the Back in the USSR blog, which is Proletarian Guard at blogspot.com. And that is, you know, Proletarian Guard, all one word, .blogspot.com. That is the Back in the USSR blog, and all this content can be found there. Now, I've been talking a lot about atrocities on this show, but the growing solidarity with Palestine, you know, with the BDS movement in particular, you know, it really is a cause for hope. In addition to what we've seen, you know, in addition to that, like in addition to the you know, the growing solidarity with Palestine, and the overwhelming condemnation of Israel and, you know, in its massacres, you know, the overwhelming condemnation of that around the world. In addition to all that, we have seen just in this past week some real democratic victories for the people happening around the world, happening in several countries. So in Ireland, The Irish people just voted overwhelmingly to overturn the constitutional ban on abortion. You know, massive victory for women's rights in Ireland. And when I say overwhelming, I really mean it. I mean, urban, rural, young, middle-aged, even relatively old people, major majorities across virtually every demographic, according to exit polls that were released today, in what amounts to a cultural revolution, you know, a cultural revolution in a historically Catholic and socially conservative country. You know, just amazing leap forward for women's rights in Ireland. You know, and that it really is a democratic victory for the people. You know, this is the people standing up and demanding change and getting it. And I also want to talk very briefly about the recent decision by Donald Trump to walk away from the upcoming negotiations with North Korea. Now, that, needless to say, is not a democratic victory for the people. You know, the DPRK has ended missile tests, demolished one of its one and only, actually, nuclear test site, and engaged in meaningful dialogue with South Korea. But, of course, the U.S. response has been to continue with ongoing war games simulating an invasion of North Korea, you know, deploying nuclear-capable B-52 bombers to the region, and then saying that they want to impose a, quote, Libya model on the DPRK, you know, which basically translates to, they want to invade the country and kill its leader, just like what they did with the NATO assault on Libya in 2011, you know, a country that had voluntarily disarmed, given up its nuclear weapons program, and made a deal with the West. And that deal didn't save it from destruction in the end. I mean, Libya was destroyed in 2011 and has not recovered. So, needless to say, the fact that Donald Trump walked away, that's not the democratic victory. What the real democratic victory for the people amid all this, the real democratic victory here against all the threats, you know, amid all the threats and amid all the imperialist saber rattling coming from the U.S. and the threats to destroy North Korea and all this sort of stuff. And the real democratic victory is the solidarity, the immense solidarity of the Korean people. The Korean people want peace. Overwhelmingly, they want peace. They want a peace treaty. They want a conclusive end to the Korean War after decades and decades of the threat of a return to war. You know, they want peace. 85% of South Koreans support the peace process. You know, the negotiations between North and South Korea that began this year. And they are not going to permit Donald Trump or anyone else to ruin it for them. You know, this is their land. They're Koreans. This is their land. And they are determined to exercise their self-determination as a people, both North and South, and come to an agreement, you know, to build peace between themselves. So you have Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in, you know, President of North Korea and President of South Korea meeting again today, you know, and embracing in defiance of the U.S., you know, and they once again pledge their commitment to a made in Korea peace process, a peace deal that will end the war, that will bring peace and ultimately reunification, the Korean Peninsula. Because the Koreans are ultimately one people, and they see themselves as such. And they want peace. They're demanding peace. They're fighting for peace. And I have every confidence that they will succeed. You know, in defiance of whatever, you know, U.S. imperialism tries to throw at them, you know, however the U.S. tries to sabotage, you know, these peace negotiations, I have every confidence that the Korean people who desire peace will succeed in building that peace. You know, as Thomas Sankara used to say, when the people stand up, imperialism trembles. Now, this is what journalist Jim Shurrock, who has done a lot of coverage on the situation in Korea, said recently on The Real News about this. And really, it comes down to, once again, the Korean people pushing for peace, you know, pushing for negotiations, pushing hard. you know, in defiance of whatever the U.S., the warmongering U.S. government tries to do. So please stay tuned back in the USSR.